a lot of people know that your dad was the governor. I mean, I know that this is a real political family. I mean, three of your siblings I've spoken to who are skilled practitioners in politics. How old were you when your dad first ran for office?
I was two.
Okay.
He's running for the state Senate.
So you grew up in this. When did you begin to think of this as something you would want to do?
I think it was actually probably after college. When I was in college, I wasn't thinking about it. Sometime after college, I don't know exactly when. I was fortunate because I had a good role model, someone who not only cared about doing a good job, did his job with integrity every minute he did it. And even though he had lost a lot of primaries for governor, remember, he won on his fourth try. Try that sometime. That's a pretty tough road. But he was never cynical or negative. After he'd lose a campaign, he'd never come home and blame his staff or blame the world. He just went on with his life. So he was a good example of not just how to do the job, how to do your work with integrity, but also how to handle the rough patches when you lose. So I was fortunate. And I was obviously drawn to some of the work that he had done. So we ended up both having served as Auditor General pretty early in our careers.
Right. There are 67 counties in this state.
Right.
You've been to them all. Did you go to county dinners with him and meet people?
Not a lot. And it's interesting because I think most families, they're immersed in it from the time they're kids. And we were exposed to it, but it would be very limited. Like, he would announce his candidacy, as they used to do in the old days. Say January of the year you're running, we'd go to the announcement of the press conferences, maybe travel with him that day. But between that day and another event could often be weeks, if not months. He didn't take us on the road a lot. And actually, in retrospect, I'm thankful for that, because a child should be allowed to live as normal a life as possible with obvious exposure to politics like my daughters have had. But I think if you immerse them in it every day, they become just detached from reality and their schoolwork and their – they ought to be able to live a normal life. And the other thing I try not to do is bring it home too much. Now, that's harder – in these times we're living in.
Because of social media, kids are connected
more.
Yeah,
people are immersed in the politics of politics more than we were. It just wasn't the obsession that it is today.
Is there any advice from your dad that you turn to in tough times?
The basic, kind of the fundamental advice, which is the one thing that a politician can control about your office and your work is ethics, right? You can't control the political winds. You can't control national or world events or things that will affect your election or your service sometimes. You can't always control the politicians you're working with. But you can control your own personal ethics and the ethics of your staff. So he set very high standards. And that's probably the best. If there's any advice I give to young elected officials or people running for office, it's that. That's the one thing you can control. And if you set high standards and demand that everyone follows them, you're going to have a much better foundation as a public official. But and the other thing was, his other advice was hire good people. When I was became Auditor General, he had very simple advice. He said, "You need a good lawyer to help you deal with the main job there is what's in the fiscal code, and you need a lawyer to help you through that and help you through other things." And he said, "You also need a really good audit deputy." So I got someone who was probably the best person that ever served in that position, Terry Kostoff. And I think when I asked him to serve in that position, he was a Republican. I never asked him if he changed parties. But wow, did he do a good job as a professional. And so get good people, have an ethical foundation, and work hard. That's probably the...
I want to talk about your record as a senator and your positions. Reproductive rights is a big issue in Pennsylvania and
right.
Probably a bigger issue with changes coming on the Supreme Court. How would you describe your perspective on what government should and shouldn't do in this area?
Well, first of all, one thing we should not do, and this has become a kind of a core principle, not just a principle or a focus, but it's become a repeated legislative strategy for Republicans, and that's to prevent Planned Parenthood from getting federal dollars. And one of the misnomers there, or the misconceptions, is that somehow Planned Parenthood gets a line item in the budget. What Planned Parenthood does is bill for services. So when there's a screening of one kind or another, when they're providing family planning services, contraception, they bill the federal government and they're reimbursed. Because of federal law, there's always been a separation between what they bill for and obviously Planned Parenthood does provide abortions, but that's a separate stream of money, and there's always been a separation there. So I think the one thing we should not do is undermine the work of Planned Parenthood, undermine the ability of appropriators to fund the Title X family planning program the federal government has. That's kind of not talked about as much, but it's also part of this equation. And what we should also do is make sure that in the United States of America, when someone becomes pregnant, they have two choices. They have a constitutional right to choose abortion, but they also can bring that child to term. And if we're doing the right thing, we're going to do everything possible to say to that pregnant mom, we're going to help you in any way we can, and we're going to do, frankly, more than either party's been willing to do. That's why when you're talking about reproductive rights and pregnancy itself, we have basic programs that people rely upon: the WIC program, the Medicaid program, all kinds of prenatal programs. So that if that mom or that pregnant mother chooses to bring that child to term, especially if she has all kinds of disadvantages by way of income and otherwise, we have to show, I believe, total solidarity with her and help her. And I think that's the right approach. And I think that you got a lot of ideologues in Washington that have even questioned the idea of contraception and providing support for that.
So you do believe there is a constitutional right to an abortion?
Well, that's what the Supreme Court has said.
And you believe Roe versus Wade was correctly decided?
I have never agreed with Roe. At the same time, you have to decide, what do we do about this debate? Do we continue the way the debate has gone on for decades, or do we figure out a place to land which is common ground? The common ground here is both sides, despite the disagreement on the issue, both sides agree that we should reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies. Both sides should want to agree on that. Both sides agree we should reduce the number of abortions. What we don't focus on enough is what's the common ground. The common ground is family planning and contraception. If there's more of that, if it's more widely available, you're going to reduce both the abortion rate and the number of unwanted pregnancies. Both sides, I think, agree that if a woman chooses to have a child, she should be given help. I would hope that as a society, it would be a national goal to say that in the United States of America, we're going to guarantee that every pregnancy is a healthy pregnancy. So you can't cut Medicaid. That's why I got so damn angry when they cut Medicaid last year. I'm still angry about it. They're trying to cut more than $1 trillion out of Medicaid in the next 10 years. That's the official Republican Party position on Medicaid. It is obscene. It's outrageous, and it's insulting to our values as Americans. I also get mad when they try to cut the WIC program. When they try to cut funding for basic programs that help.
Let me get back to Roe because time is a little short. You believe Roe versus Wade was not correctly decided?
I've always believed.
In what way?
Well, I mean, you want us to give 2 minute answers? it's a major constitutional.
Well, should the courts permit abortion? I mean, there are people who believe that there should be abortion bans. In 2009, I believe, when the Affordable Care Act was being debated, you supported amendments which would have prohibited insurance plans under the exchanges from funding abortion. They were defeated. You voted for the act without that provision. But it seems as if you have supported efforts to restrict abortion.
Well, yeah, we've had – look, in my time in the Senate, we've had very few – I've been there 12 years almost 12 full years. We've had very few votes that have been kind of up or down votes on abortion directly. Now, some in Washington want to make every Planned Parenthood vote an abortion vote. I think that's, a Washington way of creating conflict. The Planned Parenthood's votes are about whether or not Planned Parenthood can do the work that it does on a whole range of health services. That's not an abortion vote. But on the we've had a few abortion votes since I've been in the Senate, not many. And I think that's – I mean, my position has been pretty clear, I think, for all those years.
And that position is you remain
– I'm a pro-life Democrat, which was actually it's – and the word – both words are important. It means that you want to reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies, and you want to make sure that we help pregnant women. Think about if in this country, instead of the debates we've had for 25 years, where sometimes both sides want to engage in the fight for many years, think about if we just focused on four words, say, contraception, help pregnant women. If everyone focused on that and really made it a national goal to make sure that we're supporting programs that allow for contraception and also allow for healthy birth, what most people want to go down, those numbers would actually go down. But instead, people in Washington want to keep having a fight instead of landing on common ground.
Right. I mean, those principles govern a lot of circumstances. But when a woman wants an abortion, do you believe the government should get in the way?
I believe that when under current law, she's allowed to have that abortion. I also think that if a woman is pregnant and she wants to have the child but cannot because of impediments in her way and circumstances in her way, I mean, we know from the data that something in the order of 40% of abortions can be attributable to not, you know, economic factors. And as a country, we have never said to her, we really haven't, neither party has really said to her, if you want to care that child to term, we're gonna provide all the help that you need. And by the way, that help should continue not just through the 9 months, should continue after that. That's why Medicaid is essential. That's why WIC, Women, Infants, and Children's Program is essential. That's why prenatal and after the birth, all those programs are not only vital, but they are under assault. If Republicans had their way last year, not only would Medicaid be cut substantially, and they still want to cut it by $1 trillion, they would have wiped out Medicaid expansion. And because of the Affordable Care Act, in Philadelphia, just in the city of Philadelphia, 167,000 people got health care through Medicaid expansion. When you add the others from the exchanges, it's about 223. But 75% of the people who got health care in this city from the Affordable Care Act got it through Medicaid expansion. The official Republican Party position is to eliminate Medicaid expansion. That's what all their bills would do. Not eliminate in the first year, but over time, eliminate that part of Medicaid. And that's an abomination that I'm just not going to stand for.
Would you describe yourself as a pro-life Democrat who supports abortion rights? That's one way people have characterized you.
I don't think that's accurate, but I also think that you've got a lot of people that want to perpetuate a conflict where we should be working on common ground. That's what I think my record reflects, especially my votes and the fights that I get in.
In what way is that description of you, a pro-life Democrat who supports abortion rights, inaccurate?
Well, obviously, if you say you support abortion rights, I think that by definition that means you support Roe. And I think my voting record is contrary to that. We've had a few, not many, maybe 2-3 votes where there's been a vote about a limitation, and that I think that's there's a basic conflict there. And I think that it comes down to the basic question: do you believe there's a life there or not? And once you decide that question, then you have to decide, well, as a public official, what are you going to spend your time doing? And I've decided to spend my time focusing on reducing the number of unwanted pregnancies, reducing the abortion rate, and that's why you have to focus on contraception and helping that helping a pregnant woman.
There are bills that would prohibit abortions after 20 weeks. Would you support them?
We've had votes on those, and we've had we had one in early this year and one in 2015, and I voted yes on both.
Okay. Let's talk about gun rights. When you were elected and then reelected in 2012, you were known as a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. And I believe after the Virginia Tech shootings and the theater shooting in Aurora, Colorado, you were quoted as saying you didn't think new legislation would positively affect the situation.
Right.
Things changed after the Sandy Hook killings. Talk about that and where you stand on gun control.
There's no question that I don't think a news event I can't think of another news event that affected my thinking on a public policy issue more than what happened at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. That weekend, I just happened to be home. I had driven I was in a car being driven from Pittsburgh to Scranton and listening to the coverage that Friday afternoon. And I was home, you know, all day Saturday, all day Sunday, and just like a lot of Americans, was just taking it all in. And by the end of that weekend, I thought, wait a minute, it's relevant to also add that my wife and at least two of my daughters, I think, were home at that time, were saying, how are you going to vote? You know, in other words, we're going to be facing a set of votes on what I call common sense gun measures for the first time in years. In fact, there were almost no gun votes, so-called gun votes, that's a shorthand for it, in my first term in the Senate. Now we're going to be facing them in the months ahead. I had to decide, will you support a background check bill? Will you support a limitation on the magazines? In other words, how many bullets one person can shoot at any one time? And will you support a limit on the military-style weapon? Up or down, yes or no, 1, 2, 3. And I said yes on all three. By doing that, I changed lanes. I mean, there's only really two lanes in American politics on this issue. You really believe that no new laws will make a difference. That's one lane. That's the lane I was in. Or the other lane is, yes, common sense gun measures can reduce the likelihood. And what reduce the likelihood of a Newtown? What I had to ask myself at the end of that weekend, I'm literally having a dialogue, as we should every once in a while with ourselves, I said, are you really going to say to the people of Pennsylvania, there is absolutely nothing that the most powerful country in the world can do to prevent the horrific, indescribable, literally indescribable slaughter of 20 children in a classroom? There's absolutely no law, no change, no regulation, no policy that can change that. If that is your answer, that's a terrible answer. And that meant going to the other lane and voting for those. And obviously since then, we've had several votes that validated that position. So I get criticized for it, and they say you change and all that. Tough beans. It's the right thing to do. We have to do something to reduce the likelihood. No law will guarantee it, but we have to take action, I think.
Your opponent has criticized you for, quote, remaining silent on the sanctuary cities issue, referring to places like Philadelphia declining to honor detainer requests from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, routine requests. And they talk about one very well-known case of a guy who got out after such a request was not honored, was convicted of raping a 5-year-old. Where are you on this issue? Should the city routinely turn over people under detainer requests, and should it participate in sharing information through the database that was so controversial?
I don't think anybody wants to see sanctuary cities. It represents a system that isn't working. And if someone commits a violent crime, absolutely they should go to prison. And if they're engaged in violence here and they're here illegally, they should be deported. I mean, we can enforce the law. At the same time, what Republicans tried to do, and they've done it pretty effectively in a cynical political way, to use these issues to perpetuate a political argument instead of solving the problem. Last time I checked, my opponent has been in the majority party controlling both houses of Congress. Now they've had a president of their party for 18 months. They've done nothing on the immigration issue. They've done nothing to better protect the American people from all kinds of challenges in our immigration system, because they want to keep playing the political game.
Well, they would say they've done a lot. I mean, they've restricted immigration. They've, you know, detained kids at the border with, you know,
they've actually made us less safe. Their policies have made us less safe. Here's the Republican. Here's the whole Republican Party, including my opponent. Here's their position on immigration. They want to deport 11 million people and separate children at the border. Period. End of sentence. That's all they've done, or all they've tried to do. over and over again. If they really wanted to protect the country, they would support a bill like we had in 2013, got 68 votes in the United States Senate, dealt with all the tough issues, and it started with border security. Virtually every, I think every single Democrat in the Senate voted for it, and a good number of Republicans. It never got a vote in the House because the hard right stopped it. And if you want to solve the problem and prevent some of these challenges that communities face, you've got to pass good legislation that will secure the border and deal with our immigration system in a rational way. Deporting 11 million people, which is the official Republican Party platform or position, is not going to solve the problem.
Apart from failing to achieve immigration reform, what about this specific issue of whether cities like Philadelphia should refuse to honor these detainer
requests?
Yeah,
look, cities should try to work with Homeland Security. It's very difficult to work with Homeland Security and the Justice Department under this administration. They have a wholly different approach than the Obama administration. The Obama administration, Jay Johnson, when he was Secretary of Homeland Security, was very much engaged in trying to work with cities to have a policy that was rational. And look, it's complicated by court decisions, but it is. I still think it does get back to the basics. When someone is a violent criminal, they should be thrown in prison for sure, and everyone should work towards that goal. But you can't solve a lot of these problems without dealing with the fundamental problems we have in our immigration system. And now you have an administration that has a policy in place to separate children at the border. It's not only inhumane and wrong. It is making us less safe. We are telling the world not only that we don't want anyone. That's what the Trump administration seems to believe. We don't want anyone coming to our shores. Unless maybe if you have a PhD, but other than that, they don't want you. That's not going to solve the problem. It's not going to make us safer.
I want to move on, but I didn't hear an answer to the question of should cities like Philadelphia refuse to honor these detainer requests from the Customs?
I think any city should work with the federal government, but when the federal government makes it impossible by cramming down the throats of a city. A policy that doesn't make sense. The administration has a responsibility here to engage with cities and communities like Jay Johnson did when he was Secretary of Homeland Security, like the Justice Department did in those years. But you have a bunch of ideologues who run these agencies. This is a hard right administration. It's not populist. It's hard right.
The Obama administration also wanted to get those detainer requests honored, and Mayor Nutter didn't want to honor them. So.
Well, no, in those years, they're actually working together, and they were headed down a path where they were working together. That should be the goal. But the administration makes it very hard because, look, the administration and my opponent, they don't want to solve these problems. They want to keep having the political argument so they can win elections. But I think it's very hard to call them serious about policy when their entire immigration agenda is two things. Deport 11 million people and separate kids at the border. That's what they're trying to do.
Okay. The Republican opponents like to call you Senator Zero. This came up in 2012, suggest that you just don't get anything done in Washington. Yeah. What do you say to them?
Well, let's see what my opponent has done just this year with the president that he follows around so much. I passed a bill to help grandparents who are dealing with the opioid crisis. Susan Collins and I got it passed. The president signed into law this year. Pat Toomey and I got a bill done that says if you're the child of a, and you're eligible for Pell Grants, but you're the child of a law enforcement officer, and that parent is killed in the line of duty, you can get the maximum Pell Grant. That's law. The grandparents' bill is law. Mike Enzi, a conservative from Wyoming, and I, we just got done for the first time in 12 years. A complete reauthorization of the career and technical education law. Every chamber of commerce, every workforce development group in the country was pleading with us to get this done. Mike Enzi and I got it done. The president signed it into law a couple of weeks ago. I wasn't at the bill signing. That's a whole other story. I didn't get invited, but I didn't care. I just want to get the bill passed. But
wait a minute.
On issue,
this is a bill that you were behind.
Right.
You were not invited to the signing ceremony, and you did what?
Well, I didn't go. I wasn't invited.
Oh, you didn't show up. Okay. Yeah, you were not at the signing ceremony.
I would have liked to have been there.
Okay, go ahead.
But so just this year, I've passed major pieces of legislation signed into law by this president. In addition to that, the ABLE Act, which was probably the most significant disability legislation since the ADA in 1990, allows families for the first time to save in a tax-advantaged way for a disability like you save for college. So if you have two daughters, one has Down syndrome, one doesn't, and she's headed to college and you're saving for her, why the hell shouldn't we let the family save for both? Now we can under the tax law because of my bill with Richard Burr, a conservative Republican from North Carolina. So I can go down, I can take more time and go down the list, but it just doesn't hold up to the scrutiny of, I think, you know, Republicans are going to try to come up with lines like that, but it didn't work in 2012. I guess they're going to just try to rebrand it this year.
They also call you an obstructionist. We spoke to a voter in recently who'd voted for you in 2012, a woman from Westchester, and she said, well, she's going to vote against Bob Casey because you can't vote no for everything and expect your constituents to stand behind you. One of the things they point to is you said that you would not vote for the Supreme Court nominee even before the name was announced.
That's correct.
Is this obstructionism?
It's not because of – look, the world has changed in more ways than one, not simply that – the Republican Party in the calendar year 2017, continuing to 18, have had at least, by my judgment, a twin obsession. They want to give rich people and corporations more money. That's point one. And point two is they want to decimate programs like Medicaid. And they're just getting warmed up. So when that happens, you either be a doormat or you be a fighter. I chose to be a fighter. And just otherwise, you know, our party could have very easily said, go ahead, repeal the Affordable Care Act. Let 20 million people lose their health care, and you will pay a political price for that. We could have done that as a party. It would have been morally corrupt, and long-term it would have been bad politically. We decided to fight like hell, and I did as well. And I'm damn glad I did, and I'm not going to stop fighting. Dave, I've said on health care, I'm going to be even-tempered. I'm going to be always angry if they try to do these things. And I don't care what it costs me. I don't care if I didn't do anything else for the rest of my life. I'm going to stop them from cutting those programs. No matter what it takes. No matter what it takes. I don't care if they call me an obstructionist. I don't give a damn what labels they use. It is that important to me and to the country. Secondly, what also changed when it came to the Supreme Court is we have never had a president or an administration who is so beholden to the hard right, the corporate right. Right now it is literally the case. This is literally fact. We've had two Supreme Court nominations who have been picked not by the Chamber of Commerce or some usual interest group that tends to align with Republicans. There are only two groups that matter in the Supreme Court, Federalist Society and Heritage Foundation. I represent a state that has a strong labor tradition supporting working men and women. The Heritage Foundation calls unions cartels. They think people in unions are criminals. That's the Heritage Foundation. I will not allow myself to be complicit in a court packing, a corporate court packing of a court that is already too corporate. All the evidence shows that. Look at the studies they've done of 5-4 decisions that favor corporations. They're all tilted that way. Judge Kavanaugh will only add to that. And you know what? The 25 names on that list were, first of all, it was a corrupt political bargain in the campaign where Donald Trump shook hands with two groups, not the American people, the Heritage Foundation and Federalist Society, two far-right groups, are picking the United States Supreme Court. If Barack Obama stood up on his first day as president and said, the only people who are going to choose the Supreme Court from my list of 25 is going to be the ACLU or some group, right? They're going to pick all the American people would be justifiably outraged. Republicans would be screaming and yelling. We cannot allow a third branch of government to be chosen by the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation. I don't care what people call it. I'm not going to be part of that. Or I can go through the charade of sitting down and pretending that he's a mainstream conservative. He's hard right. And they had a lot of other choices. Several hundred conservative Republican judges who are not on the list of 25.
You've always been an even-tempered guy, I would say. That's your reputation. Several people have said to me, Bob Casey seems to have had a personality transplant since Donald Trump took office. You were at the airport protesting his initial immigration ban. You do a lot of Facebook Live things. You're connecting with activists. Would you say that things are different now? Your approach to public life is different now?
Well, my approach has to be different. Times have changed. This presidency has changed the lives of so many Americans. I have never seen more people who have been both engaged and enraged at the same time on most days. And sometimes, frankly, we spend too much time reacting to the personality of the president and the outrages, which are insulting to a lot of people, and we forget to focus on the policy. Just think about where we are. You've got the hard corporate right that controls both branches of the two branches of government. Now they want to get the deciding vote on the Supreme Court. So that has changed. When they threatened health care, when they rammed through a tax bill, they passed a tax bill in December of last year where 83% of the benefits are going to go to the top 1%.
According to the Tax Policy
Center. Right.
Center, but it's the last year after some middle class breaks expire.
Yeah, but think about it this year. This year, the top 1% is getting the average taxpayer in the top 1% is getting $51,000 a head. The percentage of the break is much higher for the top 1% than it is for the middle. I mean, people go to Center on Budget and Policy Priorities for the budget votes, but they can also go to Tax Policy Center. I think it's the December 18th report. Read that report about what happened to the middle class in that and what happened to the top 1%. So all of this has changed, and you have a president who in his first week in office puts forward an executive order that's a Muslim ban. Open and shut case, it was a Muslim ban. If I don't oppose that, who am I? I mean, these are an insult to basic American values. The strongest country in the world can take care of people in health care, that we can have a rational system of immigration and dealing with refugees and kids at the border. That's American. He's taken us in a different direction. So if I didn't get angry about these things, I probably shouldn't be in public office.
Donald Trump won Pennsylvania, as you know, narrowly 2 years ago.
44,292.
Very close election, right? You are running against an opponent who is one of Donald Trump's earliest and most ardent supporters. To what extent do you think this election—
I think he's probably the president's favorite candidate in the entire country. Literally, his favorite candidate.
So do you think this is going to be a referendum on President Trump's administration? His leadership?
I think an election in the the second year of a presidency is always has part of that. But I also think that the fundamental choice people are going to have to make is in this make or break moment for the middle class is which candidate here has not only will stand up for the middle class and people trying to get to the middle and people that are vulnerable that could be badly harmed by policy out of Washington, which candidate not only will stand up for them, but which candidate has a record to prove that. And I don't think it's even close. But I think it's going to be a very tough campaign because of the kind of state we have and because it's I've got a lot of forces against me. I have the President of the United States campaigning against me. You can see he came to Wilkes-Barre and had some commentary about me. Then you have these outside groups that are allied with my opponent, the president. So there's some powerful forces out there. We've got to work very hard to win and earn every vote.
Senator Casey, thanks so much.
Dave, thank you.